towards the end of the service, an initiate who carried a silver receptacle came out from one of the tunnels and handed it to the priest, who put it on the altar, consecrated it with great profusion of sungpos, and then poured out its contents into several hundred small vases, apparently made of magical signs of pure gold, and held up to him on trays by the assistants. I strained my eyes a little to find out something about the nature of the liquid while it was being poured out. It was blood red. Narabu told me afterwards that it actually was blood. When I asked him what kind of blood, he said he was not allowed to answer. Then the procession started again, the hierophants one by one going up to the altar and emptying the contents of one vase each with great devotion. This closed the service. There was a mighty peal of underground bells, and the priest and his assistants who bore his train withdrew in a ceremonious fashion and entered the central tunnel in the northern wall of the temple, after having sprinkled the audience with an abundant supply of holy water. The brothers walked out in solemn procession, none of them daring to look at anyone else. When going out, I noticed that the lower part of all the walls of the temple was an uninterrupted succession of silver-edged glass cases entirely filled with human bones. A rapid calculation showed that the temple contained so and so many truckloads of human bones. Needless to say, I had not gone up to the altar, and had merely stood up and sat down from time to time out of politeness. After a short talk with Nabu, I went to bed. It was about midnight. I slept deeply, and about 10 o'clock in the morning I set out for a long walk in the neighborhood. I took along some food, intending to return in the afternoon. I felt quite fit, and by noon I was at a distance of at least 7.5 miles from the city when I heard the rumble of thunder in the distance. I had left my tent in the holy city, and for the first time during my travels in Tibet I had nothing to protect myself from a Tibetan thunderstorm, which usually is very violent. When I had walked back a few miles towards the city, I was overtaken by the thunderstorm. There was absolutely nothing that could have been used to afford shelter, so all I could do was to lie down flat on the ground and wait for the storm to pass. The thunderstorm was unusually violent. Flashes of lightning followed one another in rapid succession, and after about 5 minutes I was literally drenched to the skin. As I dislike walking about in drenched clothes, I stripped them off, made a bundle of everything I had on me, and greatly enjoyed this unexpected shower bath. Fortunately, there was no hail, and after about half an hour the thunderstorm had passed and the sun came out. I wrung out my clothes and spread them out. It was about 1 p.m. The temperature in the sun was something like 50 degrees centigrade, and in the intense heat the clothes dried with remarkable rapidity. By about 3 they were fairly dry. I put them on and, after a meal of tsamba soaked in water, walked back to the city. Those of my readers who are versed in occultism may know that there is no better occult disinfectant than water, and especially water coming barley meal down from the sky. It washes away all magnetic currents sent into one's body and into one's clothes by outward agents. Water absorbs magnetic currents with great eagerness. It is an occult purifier par excellence. The thunderstorm must have demagnetized me, if I may use that word, and washed away most of the magical currents which had no doubt been brought to bear on me during the last few days. When I had returned to the city, it seemed to me as if my capacity to view things in an absolutely matter-of-fact way had considerably increased. I went to the residential building of the members of the Brotherhood where guests were not allowed to enter. When I arrived, I found that the superintendent had already been informed that the Prince of Light had granted permission for me to visit the library where usually only members of the fraternity are admitted. Organization in the city seemed to be faultless. Nothing was ever overlooked. Everything seemed to be planned and organized, and it is a well-known fact that various dogmatic religions, such as the Catholic Church and Lamaistic Buddhism, discouraged the practice of bailing for many centuries. In the Middle Ages, the Catholic Church took up a vigorous stand against the immoral practice of bathing, and the lamas up to this day greatly encourage the fear of water entertained by the Tibetan multitude when the use of water is recommended for cleansing the body. One may wonder whether these organized religions took or take such an attitude because they realize that human bodies are demagnetized and cleaned of certain occult currents by the practice of bathing, thus making it more difficult for them to maintain their spiritual control of the multitude. As far as the Catholic Church is concerned, they are a much too practical body to maintain an attitude which would seem too incongruous with the period in which we live. That is why the Catholic Church now no longer takes a stand against bathing, but the lamas still do so. That is why it is used for making holy water in temples and churches. Recorded. Things in an anthill could not work more smoothly, I thought. Naobu happened to be in the library, and rose to greet me. The walk, the neutral atmosphere outside the city, and the good wash-up seemed to have increased my capacity to examine things objectively. Naobu's eyes seemed to have become a little more lifeless. It was as if an occult magneto had drawn out of him all that was best in him, his soul, his freedom, his personality. I listened to his voice. It sounded metallic and more soulless than it had sounded in his song. I told him that I had been out for a walk. While I talked to him, I began to listen to the sound of my own voice. It had a metallic and coated touch too. It was not hoarseness, oh no, it was a much more dreadful thing. I left Naobu, who was studying a manuscript written in Sanskrit, and went over to a mirror. When I saw myself, I stepped back aghast. Never before had I seen my eyes, the windows of the soul, gazing so lifelessly. Where was I? There was something strange about my features too. There was something of the grin of a demon in them. What did all that mean? I walked round the circular library building, brilliantly lit by the daylight flooding in through the ceiling. I examined the pictures on the walls. There were reproductions of various soul saviors and redeemers of past ages. There were pictures which seemed to be enlarged reproductions of the Supreme Jewel and his foremost lieutenants. I looked into their eyes. They were beautiful but gloomy. All was there, intelligence, power, but no, soul I, everything in me cried out in own wild agony. I sat down and put my hands before my face. I had recognized the nature of all these saviors of souls. They were fallen angels. They were angels who had lost their glory because they had wanted to be like God. And when they had thus precipitated themselves into the bottomless abyss from which there is no return, just like a mountain climber who makes a dash to soar to the sun but falls down into the abyss, the fallen angels turned against the Creator and now live for the purpose of making others share their dreadful fate by dragging them down with them into the abyss. The Prince of Light was really the Prince of Darkness in disguise. The few minutes following this realization were the most dreadful of my life. My whole being cried out in spiritual agony. Outwardly I was quiet and composed, but inwardly I was in the grip of a spiritual storm shaking the very foundations of my being. So intense was my agony that it is beyond the power of words to convey a description of it. Only people who have had a glimpse of the spiritual can realize what the term soul agony of the greatest intensity really means. It was as if the experience of hundreds of incarnations, the suffering of whole existences, was concentrated into the space of a few minutes of spiritual anguish. So intense was my agony that it must have disturbed the whole psychical atmosphere of the city of the initiates. I now positively felt powerful magnetic currents rushing in me from all sides to extinguish this newly acquired spiritual realization. A door opened and the prince entered the library, attended by only two secretaries. Everybody rose to his feet. He came up to me. "Have you taken your decision?" he asked in a beautiful but dreadfully hollow and metallic voice. "Yes," I answered firmly. He blew one mighty breath right into my face. "Confounded sorcerer," I thought, "now you reveal your real nature a left step back. In the name of the Creator," I almost shouted in a mighty voice. I think never before had I heard my own voice so full of vigor and soul power. My whole being fused into one indissoluble unit, and my whole self lay in that voice. The ruler recoiled. He then briskly turned and left the library. I suddenly realized that the penalty for recognizing the real nature of such a being must be death. I have explained before that the palace was connected with the other buildings by subterranean passages. The prince could thus reach any other part of the underground city in a few minutes. Blowing into another man's face is a certain characteristic of demons or their servants or disciples incarnated in the flesh. By these means they try to get hold of their man and obtain a good basis for subsequent magical operations destined to deprive him of his free will. The best spiritual armor against this dreadful practice is an iron will, intense iron soul consciousness, and the mental attitude of "May the Creator punish you for that without hatred." I the best physical remedy against blows by demons is the eating of beans, bread prepared with much yeast, and similar kinds of food which produce abundant gases inside the body. Having failed to snatch my soul while I was alive and had the protective shield of my intelligence, he would no doubt try to murder me by occult practices, as it might be easier for him to snatch my soul on the other side. I had always possessed courage. Once a gun had gone off a few inches from my face, the bullet piercing my nose, but friends had assured me that I had hardly moved my eyelashes. I have been to the most deserted parts of the world alone, carrying my own food to last 15 days when I knew that a sprained ankle or some other minor accident would mean certain death. I have been face to face with death many times without showing the slightest emotion. But now it was a different matter. I was not fighting for life, but for my soul. It was as if a bottomless abyss had opened before my feet and a cold hand tried to tear open my heart and to draw me away from the Creator forever. For the first time in my life I fell in terror. When running out to reach my room to fetch my belongings and leave the city, never to return, I made the mistake of running towards the sanitation building instead of the guest house. As said before, all the buildings in the city were alike from outside. I ran downstairs, passing with lightning rapidity through the two corridors corresponding to the ones I used to take when going to my room in the guest house. I had not realized that I was in the wrong building, and when two servants got up to stop me, I simply pushed them aside with as little violence as was absolutely necessary and opened a door. I was in the kitchen of the city, to which no one except the kitchen staff and the highest initiates had access. A human corpse lay in the center of the kitchen. Lifeless and automaton-like, cooks cut off small pieces of flesh. 10 or 15 large pans made of massive silver were suspended over so many fires apparently fed with alcohol, and the pieces of human flesh were passed on to boards where they were carefully cut up into small pieces. It was not quite certain, of course, that the contents of the silver pans were destined for the members and guests of the holy city, but the very possibility of my having partaken of such food was dreadful. If human flesh was actually mixed into our food, it was small wonder that it had disagreed with me. The cooks gave a mighty stare at the intruder, but 2 or 3 seconds were enough to have a look at the whole kitchen, and I immediately rushed back to the guest house. Narbu had followed me from the library. He had lost sight of me and now anxiously looked round in all directions while he stood before the guest house. "Wait here, please," I cried, and a minute later I was back with my belongings, including the urine bottle, which I did not want to leave behind as I realized that it would provide an excellent basis for magical operations directed against me. I always avoid unnecessary harshness. Narbu accompanied me out of the city to the slabs displaying the inscription, "Border." After all, it was he who had invited me, and it was up to him to see me safely to the precincts of the city. "So you are going," said Narbu sadly. The poor, kind-hearted man. He thought he was in the city of a great light power, and the thought that I did not want salvation made him sad. For a moment I contemplated whether I should tell him bluntly that he really was in the city of the evil one, but strange to say I felt that I could not. For spiritual realizations entail enormous spiritual responsibilities. Even the powers of evil have their spiritual mission. They snatch souls if men themselves give them up. By his spiritual sins man himself weakens the ties which link him to his soul, and the more he sins spiritually the more he strikes himself with blindness until he can no longer see the difference between God and the Creator, no matter how high are his occult accomplishments. The devil tempts, but he can only seize souls that voluntarily yield to his temptation. That is a law of the universe. I felt I could save no one from the evil one. By telling Narbu that the exalted jewel was identical with the Prince of Darkness, I should have influenced his spiritual attitude and interfered with his spiritual destiny, which lay in his own hands. I felt I had no right to do that, for the supreme spiritual law is absolutely using the impersonal for personal uses. Selfish prayers, and wanting to be like God are the two most frequent spiritual sins. Free choice by every individual. Man himself can choose resplendent light, but he himself can also throw himself down into the bottomless abyss from whence there is no return. Oh, the dreadful tragedies of spiritual life! There stood Narbu, kind-hearted and only afflicted with a slight dose of spiritual arrogance, but otherwise good at the core. He wanted to save me, although it was he himself who needed salvation, and I could not save him. I had to leave him to his fate. I felt the dreadful tragedy of the moment when I greeted him and went on my way. Just as the tiniest creature has its mission in the universe, every spiritual force, be it one belonging to the upward trend of life or to the downward, has its mission too. It is bound by spiritual laws which are inherent to its very nature. No special oath is required to keep it within these bounds. No spiritual creature can act in a way contrary to its spiritual nature. God and devil both go their own way. And the creature can seize at will the upward or downward trend of life. The more he sins against his soul, the more he will strike himself with blindness. But once he goes to his doom, no one can save him. I had been for 3 days in the city of the initiates, but the experience of whole decades seemed to have been crowded into these 3 momentous days. Footnote. Kind-hearted Narbu died suddenly some time after I had left the Holikti. It was not necessary for me, therefore, to hold back certain secrets out of consideration for him. Chapter 5, The Flight. I turned towards the region where my Tibetan hermit friend lived, whose brother had procured me Tibetan clothes south of the Gobi Desert. I felt that the ruler of the holy city would not feel safe while I lived, and as it was quite impossible for him to have me murdered openly, be it only out of consideration for Narbu, whose eyes might have been opened by such an occurrence, he would no doubt try to kill me by powerful magical operations. Even attacks of this kind become more difficult when the distance separating the magician from his enemy increases, and as I had no desire to fight these currents more than was absolutely necessary, I intended to set out at the rate of about 30 miles a day and take a rest upon my arrival in the abode of the wise hermit. It was late in the evening, and as soon as night had fallen I put up my tent at a place about 8 miles distant from the underground city. I naturally chose a place where I was hidden by small ridges. I knew that the magical attacks I had to expect would in all probability be brought to bear during the night, about 12 to 1 being the worst hours, and that so long as I remained awake and from families living in the district, and instead of cutting them up they had devised some trick to steal the dead bodies and smuggle them into the city under the cover of night. The people coming from the city had arrived. I recognized them by their resplendent black robes. They were masters in the occult brotherhood. They knelt down near the lifeless bodies and then magical operations were started to resuscitate them. I am sorry I must withhold a few details relative to these practices, for some of the operations were so disgusting that I must abstain from giving a description, be it even in Latin. After strenuous work greatly varying in duration, 3 of the lifeless bodies had begun to move and walked on towards the city mechanically, like so many robots, led on by one of the masters. Were the lifeless bodies really dead before the resuscitation practices were started? If so, it was dreadful to imagine what kind of servants had cleaned my room and prepared the food in the holy city. 5 other lifeless bodies where the resuscitation practices had failed to take effect were carried on towards the holy city. Being of a practical disposition, the exalted jewel possibly did not wish to lose a single lifeless body he had obtained by trickery or by bribery. Those which were past hope may have been sent to the kitchen and their bones to the temple. Dreadful. As soon as the procession, preceded by the walking robots led by the masters, had disappeared from sight, I approached to ascertain whether the stretchers and numerous footsteps had left some traces on the ground. The experience had been so unusual that I wished to check up whether I could believe the evidence of my senses. After inspecting the footprints very thoroughly, I marched on. Why on earth did these people perform those dreadful ceremonies in broad daylight? They had a whole underground city where they could do all they liked, surrounded as they were by walking automatons who could never betray them. And even if such ceremonies could not be performed underground for some reason or other, why did they perform them in broad daylight? True, the chances of meeting someone in that forlorn part were exceedingly small, but, small as they were, why did they run that risk at all? Thinking further along these lines while I walked on, I came to the conclusion that if such clever rogues took any chances at all, they must have had an imperative reason for doing so. The waking up ceremonies were performed in the light of the sun that had just risen. This seemed to indicate that the cosmical currents they needed for their dreadful purpose reached their greatest intensity soon after sunrise. Sunrise and noon are the hours of God. Sunset and midnight's the hours of darkness. The devil stole cosmic forces from the Creator, then, to accomplish their own horrible work. As usual, the evil one is strongest when he snatches away the forces of the Creator and uses divine forces to his own end. Of course, all these speculations were based on the assumption that the Lagpa had really escorted dead bodies. I walked on at top speed, and once more reviewed the happenings of the last 3 days. Why had I been saved? I had come to the city on the invitation and recommendation of Narabu, who was himself misled and failed to realize the real nature of the Brotherhood. I had entered the city in a disinterested spirit to help and not in order to get something. My lion temperament had revolted when they proposed to hang round me the black ceremonial robes which were in all probability magnetized too. All their subtle magic, mesmerized food and maybe even earth tricks I knew nothing about, had failed to produce the occult results they desired, because throughout my stay in the city I had never sinned, be it even in thought. The evil one can only take those who give themselves voluntarily up to him, and where he oversteps that limit there are angels of the Creator who protect the innocent. They had tried to snatch my soul away. I love my soul, through which the Creator speaks to me through my heart. The harder they worked to snatch it away, the more desperately I clung to it. Great fires, like other turmoils in life, may destroy the weak, but they purify the strong and make him still stronger. More and more I began to be aware of the fact that life, including life on spiritual planes, was not an affair of peaceful contemplation and quiet worship, but a dreadful turmoil, a grim fight, and a bitter struggle. Corpse cutters. I met this procession 3 days earlier carrying lifeless bodies on stretchers. It might have opened my eyes at once. I might have immediately realized the real nature of the Brotherhood and thus missed the greatest experience of my life. The following 2 days were marked by all sorts of minor and greater troubles. I was attacked by whole swarms of gnats, and during the night, while I lay on the ground wide awake, I have stated earlier why I had to sacrifice sleep, I heard a succession of queer noises in the darkness. There was a scamper and a continual coming and going resembling the sounds you hear in a warehouse infested by thousands of large rats. In the morning I found that practically all my food had been eaten during the night and even my equipment damaged by bites, such as could only be attributed to rats of unusual size. The subsequent night I had the dreadful experience with murderous parasites which I have described in my earlier book. I might have bled to death had I not noticed the creatures in time. This was the third night since I had left the city, and for the first time since leaving it I had a little sleep, but every time I passed from a state of full consciousness into the state of half-consciousness which usually precedes sleep, I felt as if I lay in a coffin. So I made an effort again and again to return to full consciousness and to keep wide awake until daybreak. Once more I had plenty of time to think over the dreadful practices and strange resuscitation rites of the soul snatchers in the city of the initiates. What was the fundamental difference between the members of the Brotherhood who had given, or were on the way to give, their souls to the evil one, on the one hand, and those lifeless servants on the other? If man really was complex, what did he consist of? Of course, realized the danger of contemplations of that sort. Consciousness, which should be totalitarian in man, then, has a tendency to split up, which is a very real danger. By indulging too much in speculations of this sort, man provides a point d'appui for the great spiritual forces forming part of the downward current of life which serve the purpose of disintegration. The physical nature of man is fivefold, I thought. There are five organic systems in a body to which all organic functions of the body can be related. Man has five senses, he has five fingers on each hand and five toes on each foot. Five seems to be the number of the creature and of man in particular. But even if we look beyond the physical aspect of man, his nature seems to be fivefold. Man is a unit composed of purely physical characteristics, sensation, feeling, intelligence, and will. So why should he not be composed of five different vehicles welded into one unit, which man does very well not to try to dissociate under any circumstances? I thought of the dreadful crime against himself and his soul committed by the Sangmai in the Tibetan monastery, see chapter 2 of this book, and of Tibetan seances, the Shiva principle of the Hindus. By the way, die in Tibetan, and spi means dead. Akpai means to when people voluntarily relinquish control over all the vehicles that rightfully belong to them, thus throwing themselves open to all sorts of disembodied entities, just like a man who might throw open his doors and windows during the night in a house built in the jungle. the difference between the members of the Brotherhood and the lifeless servants resuscitated by magical practices was the following, I thought. The brothers had given their souls to the evil one. They were men composed of a body, sensation, feeling, and intelligence. Only their will was no longer their own. They had given up their most divine attribute, their free will, to the evil one. The servants, on the other hand, I thought, were mere robots.